Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Greg Friedman with us is a modern version of that which has existed in every culture, a spiritual guide and a mentor. He builds bridges and helps a clear path in part by taking the ancient wisdom of the indigenous cultures and making it applicable to us in our everyday lives. Greg works with clients one-on-one in workshops, couples, referee, translator, as well as taking small groups of people all over the world to work with indigenous elders in remote destinations. He's studied and has done ceremonies with Peruvian shamans. He has worked with elders from various Native American cultures, and including the Yaqui, the Deer Tribe, and the Lakota. And let us say, Greg, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on. Truly a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. You know, when it comes down to it, the essence of who we are, why we are, where we are, that certain something within us that so many people, they know that's there, but they don't know how to reach in and touch it and work with it in our everyday life. Where did you discover it? Where was it for you? You saw, you realized that certain something that is that bridge to clarity.
That is a great question, first of all. And one of the key words that used in that question was realize. And in one form or another, this has always been me. And what I had to do was uncover it, recognize it, realize it. And I love realize because it really means at its core, make real. And it happens as usual by accident on purpose. Einstein said, coincidence is just God's way of remaining anonymous. And there were all the synchronistic events that actually set me out to do sweat lodges, to go out to Native American reservations and do ceremony there. And from that place, I was taken under the wing of some incredibly powerful, wise men. And they taught me, and they kicked me in the booty, and they helped me show myself to myself. And then they urged me to go on and share that with others, to teach.
Greg, why is it so hard for somebody to see themselves in their ordinary, normal life? You know, I know you talk about getting people away from their current surroundings, get them into some place that they're not familiar with so they can see what they normally wouldn't see. But what is it that normally stops us from seeing it in our everyday existence?
It's simple. We actually wind up losing perspective. It's not any different on any level than us going up to a mirror and putting our schnoz right up against it and then expecting to have any kind of perspective, any kind of vision. We often wind up becoming so enmeshed, so immersed that we lose our vision and we lose our perspective. And if we could do something by an event, which is often catalytic, or geography, which can also be catalytic, it gives us that distance. It gives us that, it jolts us out of where we were just far enough to have a little bit more point of vision.
Every religion, what it comes down to, I say, I really believe in every religion, what it comes down to, there is that spiritual essence that goes beyond what people normally see. It's like Kabbalah. Kabbalah for Judaism is that Jewish spirituality beyond the normal teachings. There's beeping on the line. That's why I'm throwing me off here. But what it is, it's Jewish mysticism. And when you come
Absolutely.
Down to it, every religion has its own essence of that clarity, that purity, that something that goes way beyond what we know to be normal.
I would agree with that entirely. As a matter of fact, without what I do on my own radio program and what I do when I'm teaching people either individually or in workshops or groups, I'll take out a map and I'll lay it out on a table and then I'll put a big pin at some random destination. And I'll look at that and I'll go, how many ways are there to get to that destination? And you'll hear all kinds of numbers thrown out, 100, 1,000, 2,000. But the truth is, and I know you know this, Michael, the truth is there's an infinite number of ways to get to any one destination. And that doesn't make your way wrong or my way right or vice versa. What it makes is a life path, and you get to choose where you want to go. But ultimately, whether it's dogmatic through religion or whether it's through somebody's own pathway without spiritual guidance, the bottom line.
Now, one of the things that we need to look at, too, is this is also a language. And once you get into that mindset of going beyond your own experiences, the language starts to appear. And I think that's really what the key is. If you don't speak it, you're not going to recognize it.
Absolutely. And what I was saying earlier was that no matter where you're going, no matter how you're getting there, it's your path, it's your process, it's your power. And you get to, and one of the ways to access that power is through language, absolutely. Another way that's vital is giving yourself the opportunity to experience. One of my favorite lines out of Buddhism that Bruce Lee actually wound up stealing was, the difference between a master and a beginner is the master has failed more times than the beginner has even attempted. And what that means is that brings in two key aspects. Gratitude and forgiveness. And if a master had failed and beat himself up over and over again without allowing for the process, he's not going to ever become a master. So there's the forgiveness. I have to allow myself to forgive myself, to be where I am as I am in the process. And also, at the same time, it's vital that I'm grateful for who I am as I am in this moment, not I'm going to be really happy for myself once I get this, or once I do this, or once I get to whatever imaginary carrot that we're dangling in front of us.
Greg, the word grateful, there's so many people who gloss over that. Grateful doesn't have to be this big, massive undertaking of something. Grateful, let me give you a couple examples of grateful. I drive up to the driveway, I pull the car into the garage, and as I'm walking into the house, I pat him on the butt and I say, thank you. You say thank you to your toaster. You say thank you to the butter you put on your bread. That's grateful. It's the appreciation and the acknowledgement that these things actually exist. We go through life and don't concentrate, don't pay attention, and things just don't exist, but they're there.
Oh, absolutely. And the universe is incessantly laying out presents in front of us. And what it takes to access those presents is being present enough to say thank you. For the little things, like you said, not kidding, like a toaster. Thank you for that. The more we can be great, it's like you listen to people talk all the time. They go, hey, how come it is that rich people always get more wealth? Well, it's the same way with gratitude. The more grateful you are for the little things, the more they wind up adding up and adding up. And then your life is a bounty all around you. You're surrounded by things that you're joyful for, grateful for.
Yeah, and there's that awareness of bringing something into existence. And let me give you a prime example. It probably is this example 50,000 times a week, but it brings the point home. Are you sitting by a desk?
Yes.
Touch the desk. Got it?
Okie dokie.
Before you touch that desk, it didn't exist, did it?
Oh, I love this one. Go on.
But that's it. It's the awareness, the attention to it, because it was there, but no, it wasn't. And life is like that. It's there, but no, it isn't unless you touch it. Because unless you touch it, you don't have to physically touch it, but unless you touch it, you're not going to bring it into your realm of awareness, your existence. And we go through life like that, and we miss so much.
Yeah, and what I hear you talking about is awakeness, visibility. The more we say thank you, whether it's thank you, God, yeah, thank you, universe, thank you, Allah, I don't care what you're thanking. Thank me, thank Michael, it doesn't matter. But the more we say thank you, the more there is to be thankful for. You're absolutely right. We bring it into existence through our gratitude.
Sure, it's appreciation, and that's really what it comes down to. And if you have to start out appreciating yourself. If you do not appreciate yourself, there's nothing you can appreciate. You can't love anybody if you don't love yourself, because how are you going to give them something you don't have? And I think that really is the key to the whole thing. You have to become it before you can share it, and you can move it out into whatever existence there is. Because if you're not it, you're not you're blank.
Oh, I agree entirely. We each are like our own little planets, and we have our own gravitational pull. And we are going to draw into our orb, our existence, what we are emanating. And if we are emanating out that the world is icky and horrible and disgusting, then not only is that going to be our reality that we realize, that we make real, but also that's the energy, that's our magnetic pull, and we're going to draw in the ick and the dirt and the yuck.
You know, we're starting to realize something. We as humans, not just in America, but every other country, we're starting to acknowledge the existence of energy, the way that energy runs our minds, our bodies, the resultant effect of what goes on with us on a day-to-day basis. And we're starting to step away from that conventional medicine or how to heal yourself or whatever, and we're seeing that there are other areas of consideration that actually work. And I think that in and of itself, when you start to get that, years ago, if you and I had been talking about this, the first vision somebody would have had in their head would be sitting by a tree with a rag wrapped around your head, you know, smoking some dope and saying, you know, more colors, man. But see, it's not woo-hoo. It's reality, and we're starting to become aware of that reality.
Well, it's funny. It's, you know, there are these people that, in air quotation marks, are uncivilized or uneducated or ignorant, that live out in remote areas, that have a wisdom that for years the medical community was poo-pooing and saying it's just a bunch of hokum, it's just a bunch of junk. And now more and more and more Western medicine is recognizing that what these old men, what these old women, these elders have been saying for years actually really has a great deal of weight and actually has some abilities to heal that go beyond the traditional methods of application.
Yeah, and it's the same thing that's going on now. I'm going to talk about religion for a moment, but in spirituality, one of the things that religion has done is brought people together, and Greg, it's given them an identity, okay, something to share with someone else. If you notice what's going on, especially in this country today, there's so many things that you could do before you can't do now. You know, they take Christianity out of Christmas and throw this out of the schools and do whatever. Because that's happening, we're starting to become separated. Now, if there's nothing to replace it, we're in big trouble, because look at quote-unquote the enemy out there. You know, they're killing for an essence or some form of God. And it's pulling them together. It's even getting kids from our own country going over to the Middle East and fighting against us. It all has to do with identity. And the more and more we pull away from what we know, the more it's scarier that it gets, because you don't know. It's not intentional. You don't know where you're going. So what I really believe is happening, if people will open their eyes, if they're not going to tie together religiously, then do it spiritually. Do it through spirituality. Maybe have that certain something that it's the glue that holds us together. Because if we don't have that, we're not going to be around for too much longer.
Michael, I agree with you entirely. However, I have a little bit different spin on it. A lot of the teachings that I do are according to a Native American medicine wheel. Every direction has an intention and an energy. If you're going in the east, it's illumination and enlightenment. If you go to the south, it's trust and innocence. If you go to the west, it's death and rebirth, and the north is intelligence and intellect. All of those places on the wheel have so much value. But really, the place you're talking about right now is none of those. The place that you're talking about is the void, the center of that wheel. And what I hear you saying is that we are losing something. Well, that losing something could be looked at as a horrible tragedy, or it could be looked at as an opportunity, because if our arms are full of something that's not serving us, then it's going to make it near impossible to pick up that thing that is going to serve us. So the void is a powerful place because it's the place of nothing, and therefore the place of the possibility of everything and anything. And it's up to us what we want to design, how we want to fill up our arms once we empty our arms. So could it be a place of horrible doom and gloom? Yeah, it could. Is it also a really wonderful opportunity to create anew the community of loving, caring, considerate, awake, aware people? Absolutely. And you know which one I'm going to vote for.
Oh, absolutely. Greg, and this is what they're not doing politically today. Instead of, you know, they need to come to the table, and I'll say what you just said in a different way. They, whoever they are, need to come to the table values neutral. You leave the gotchas at the door, and it's a place to create from. Create what you want. Be intentional with what you want. Not let the world fall apart accidentally because, you know, somebody wants something and everybody's not on the same, not on board in the same way. That's really what it is. It is that start from nothing and build from there. And nothing scares people.
It absolutely does, because that means they're going to have to leave their comfort zone. And comfort zone is a big lie of a phrase anyway.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
actually not comfortable. What it is a familiar level of pain and suffering. They know it. They've established it. Their neural pathways know it, so they don't have to be present. It disavows them of the responsibility of their own happiness, our own happiness. And if we could let go of that familiar, then we have an opportunity to embrace something that's much, much more fulfilling.
Sure. You know, and people look for happiness. They look for love. They look for all of these things. You can't find it outside of yourself. That's the key. You can be miserable. You can be in a breakup of a relationship. Somebody can be dying. There's still love and happiness inside of you. You've just got it masked for the interim.
Yes, I agree entirely. And you've got to be willing to be scared for a little bit. It's scary.
Yeah.
Change. If you look at what a snake looks like when it sheds its skin, or a baby chick after it breaks out of a egg, or even a butterfly as it breaks out of a cocoon, it's a struggle. It's hard, hard work. But look what you have when you're done. If you're a chick, you have a new life. If you're a snake, you have a new skin. And if you're a caterpillar changing into a butterfly, your entire being has shifted dramatically. You can now fly. You can now touch the sky.
Yeah, see, Greg, about 3 years ago, three, 4 years ago, somewhere along those lines, at the place that I was living in the backyard, or actually the backyard had a fence around it. I had three dogs there. But the window that was sitting right next to the steps that took you down into the yard, there was a bird who she'd built her nest there. And I remember for that period of time, we built around it. We made sure the dogs couldn't get to it. We protected it. We made sure that those eggs were going to come to fruition. And I remember when they did, and the baby birds were in there, and they were chirping, and they just looked like cute little baby birds. Well, the day that they flew, the day that they quote-unquote left home, I remember walking by, and one of them was in the nest, and it looked at me, you know, male, female, it looked at me, and it had the biggest mistrust in its eyes, like, it's got to get out of there because I'm going to get it. It didn't recognize what I was offering it. Now, here's the key to that whole thing. I could stand back and say, look what I did for you, and you don't appreciate it. No. You say, I love you, baby. Go live your life. Do your stuff.
And, I agree entirely. I love you, baby. Go do your stuff. And also, let me acknowledge this. I did that because that was gratifying to me. Doing that was a process that really gave me a feeling of fulfillment. So I'm going to appreciate that. I'm going to accept that. Then I get filled up already, so I'm not looking for that animal to act in a certain way to gratify me from the outside.
Sure. There's another way to look at that also. Let's say that you want a particular watch, okay? And I'm going to get you that watch. And it's more than I can afford. So I save and I do this. I go and get a part-time job, make money to buy the watch. And then the day comes, I've got the watch, and I hand it to you. You know, here's your gift. And you look at it and say, this is great. And then you hand it to somebody else and say, here, you can have the watch. See, the point is when we give something to someone, The moment we give it to them, it's not up to us for what they do with it. It's up to us just to give it because we've given. But if we're going to be concerned and control the direction where that gift goes, it takes away the entire power of the idea of the gift in the first place.
I agree with that entirely. Yeah, again, so we're giving that gift for our own sake, not for an exterior response.
Right. We never do anything for anybody else when they come down to it. And that's not a nasty thing. It's just understanding human nature. If I give you something from my heart, you may get the gift, but I've got the gift of giving.
Right. Exactly. And most people understand that what they're operating from is a place of, I'm giving you this because my payoff is your reaction. And if that's the case, you're setting yourself up for disappointment and frustration. And so many people go through life with parallel setups like that, expectations of a certain exterior response. You're not going to get it because all it is a projection. Looking behind you is going to cause depression. Looking in front of you is going to cause anxiety. And the only place that happiness lives is right here, right now, in this moment.
Got that loud and clear. And we are just about out of time, which I really, we could be talking about this forever. So one time, please, with your website.
It is gregfriedman.com, and Friedman spelled FRIEDMAN, gregfriedman.com.
Wonderful. Yep. Hey, Greg, thank you so much
for being
on the show.
Great,
I really appreciate
pleasure being on
what
your show. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Have fun.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I can't see anything. I've got his stuff up. Yeah, and let me tell you why also, okay? The Blog Talk show, it's totally blank. I don't even see me on it.
Okay, all right. When you see your phone,
bring that. You wrap it up. Okay. Bye. You're weird.
This is Radio Susie. The next guest is up.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Richard Hasnot with us. He is a senior marketing and innovation executive at Procter & Gamble at Gallo, a professor at Arizona State University School of Management, teaching marketing, innovation, and leadership, author of 6 books, including Proven Practical Innovation That Delivers Results, a successful entrepreneur currently running 2 companies, Innovative to Grow Experts, that's a front-end innovation and inventing consulting service, and 2, Blue Stage Creative, that's a highly innovative graphic design company serving national clients. And let us say, Richard, hi, welcome to the show.
Michael, absolutely great to be with you. It's a pleasure. I love the way you work. You just covered a couple of years of my life in a few seconds. It was quite a flashback.
It's our job to do so. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for being here. You know, I believe in today's world, especially in today's world, you know, we live in this very fast-paced, microwavable world that nobody really spends time to take a look at anything. And when we get into the different businesses, especially trying to be successful today, I really believe if you and I walk down any given street and stop and ask people what did marketing mean? What did managing mean? What is innovation? And what does leadership mean? We would get so many different definitions, and that, I think, in and of itself, Richard, is the problem today. There's no commonality of definition. Everybody's not on the same page, and we wonder why, at the end of the day, we get left empty.
Yeah, well, that's a great insight. In fact, since I work in the innovation space, I've often been asked, Richard, what is innovation? And quite frankly, Michael, I define it in a way that I think it can apply to everyone in every situation. My definition is as follows. Innovation is making something better. And usually people think of innovation applying to business, R&D, marketing, but this is where innovation, this definition of innovation, which I use with my clients and in my podcast at Innovation Best Practices Podcast, is a way that I can talk to anybody about innovation.
And isn't it a dimension of innovation? Isn't it engagement? I think one of the most important things that a leader, a manager, a business owner can have are those people who are working within that business, that marketing firm, whatever it is, that they feel actually part of it. There's ownership there. So they feel responsible for the end result at the end of the month.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, one of the things that we know about innovation is that it goes in stages, but the front end of innovation is where you actually go about developing a lot of ideas. And if you don't involve a diverse group of people in the early stages of innovation, the likelihood that you will get the really big ideas you need is very, very low. So to your point, yes, you want to involve a broad and diverse group of people, not only in terms of functions, but age, gender, old, young, male, female, in your innovation process. That's one of the elements of how you go about generating a lot of high-quality ideas.
So most people go into business, and they end up, the business fails. And it fails within not a long period of time. I think you've got down 5 years as a statistic here. But what are some of the things that causes a business not to be successful?
That's a great question, and I really hope your listeners tune into this, because we really know what makes an idea, a product or a service, succeed and fail. And to your point, for over three decades, 75% of all new products have failed. Conversely, only 25% succeed over a five-year period of time. We know there's three things that drive success. First, do you communicate a benefit that is simple, clear, and specific that your customers want? Now, you may say, Richard, that sounds like common sense, but I can tell you how many companies miss doing this. Second, in today's world of communication, when you communicate a benefit, you need to give people a reason to believe that you could actually do what you just said you were going to do. And third, you need to have, when you want to go and try and have a successful product, you need to have a dramatic difference versus some, most, or all of your competition. Because you and I know that we're not going to switch products from ones that we've been using for years or decades unless somebody comes up with something that's dramatically better. So you need a benefit that's simple, clear, and specific. You need a highly credible reason to believe, and it needs to be dramatically better than what the options customers have today. When you do that, you can double your chances to 50% or higher.
And here's what a lot of people miss in marketing, sales, et cetera. One is, and I'll get into this in a second, say I have no idea what they're selling. And let me give you a prime example of that. I've worked out at gyms all my life. I'm an old gym rat. And I go into the gym. They want to get me to sign up to belong, a membership. So they show me a machine. The machine is going to get me a big bicep. And the machine is the feature. The bicep is the benefit. So they're into the bicep. You know, but nobody ever asked me why I want the bicep. I want to go out on the beach and look good for the girls. Don't sell me the machine. Don't sell me the bicep. Sell me the beach. And,
I love it.
And I think
I love it.
That's where they miss. What do you want it for?
Michael, you're pretty good at this marketing thing. The difference, a lot of people don't even know the difference between benefits and features, and you're spot on. And here's the other point I want to build on what you just said. Sometimes we think that the benefit is only something measurable, but benefits in many cases are emotional. And if we can communicate that as a part of the message. See, we need to know what's important to our customers, and you've just indicated, hey, yeah, big bicep, but that's really a path to this other benefit that I'm looking for. And
yeah,
that's really an emotional benefit. So spot on.
You know, it's that third step. And I've seen it time and again, you know, over the years, that people absolutely don't know what they're selling. Because when you really come down to it, you're selling one thing and one thing only. And I've asked people, what are you selling for your, you know, I'm selling books, products, myself. You know, it's a long list. But you're only selling one thing. What you're selling is an answer. You're selling a solution to a problem, period, end. Because the solution or a resolve to your problems is the only thing that you're going to buy. And by the way, that word solution is so underrated. You know, you hear it over and over again, marketing, sales. But from the time you wake up in the morning till the time you go to bed at night, your entire world is solution driven. And let me give you some practical answers to that. Let's say, are you married?
Yes.
Okay, now, does your wife fill something up in your life you don't have without her?
Amen, yes.
Yeah, she's a solution, isn't she?
Yes.
Your car is a solution. Your occupation is a solution. How about the telephone you're on right now, or better yet, the chair you're sitting on? See, all of these are an answer to something. And the only thing that will motivate anybody is for them to hear an answer for either what they're looking for or what they didn't know they were looking for in that presentation. And I think that's where the key is. And that, in and of itself, has caused so many wonderful businesses not to be able to succeed and move forward. Too simple,
well,
I know.
You're right. Yeah, I think you're right. But I would just expand on it a little bit for your
sure.
consideration. Yes, you want to communicate a solution. But in today's world of skepticism about all kinds of messages, and especially advertising, you need to give people a reason to believe. And in my Innovation Best Practices podcast, episode 9, I talk about the 5 strategies for communicating a highly credible reason to believe. And if you're selling a solution, people don't, when they go looking for a solution, like going looking for a car, you don't look at only one. You've got a bunch of choices out there. And you need to be able to find the one that is dramatically better than the other options, because if you're like me, I don't have a budget to buy every car that I think I would like at any particular point in time. I need one. So those
sure.
three elements are what we know. And that's, I mean, for your listeners, I have a podcast. Each podcast is only 15 to 20 minutes long, and they can see that on the Innovation Best Practices podcast, which is on iTunes.
Sure. You know, something interesting, what you just said about, you know, I'll say it in a different way. It hits people differently. I think when you really come down to it, you take the solution and you let them put their problem on it. And I think the greatest example of that is the Nutrisystem weight loss commercial that we see on television. Left-hand side
yes.
of the screen, you got a woman about 100 pounds overweight, very depressed, solemn look on her face. Right-hand side of the screen, you got the same woman. She's lost all the weight, big smile, life is good, she's rocking. Okay. It is in that split second, that aha moment, when the recognition of the possibility of a solution is there, that the buying response is triggered. Because it's not about weight loss. It's about what that represents. Go back to the beach and the bicep. It's about the relationship they couldn't have, the job they couldn't apply for, the athletic event they couldn't participate in, and the reasons to buy go on and on. So to tie into what you were saying before, you also give them the solution, but you let them put their problem on it.
And you want to identify with it. The challenge that particular industry has today, Michael, is that it just about everybody that's advertising these sort of weight loss products has
oh, sure.
before and after pictures. And so what's going to distinguish you? I want to give you an example because I loved your side-by-side thing, and I think many of your listeners will be able to identify with this. Bounty Paper Towels has been the market share leader for 30 years behind one basic message, the quicker picker-upper. And they
yeah.
have shown the side-by-side Bounty absorbing more and faster versus another product. And it's that side-by-side thing, the same thing you just talked about, that
yeah.
is a very powerful selling tool.
You see, and I think that's really what it is. That's why, Richard, they have to have guys like you out there. You, when you're talking about marketing and selling, et cetera, you don't
yeah.
just – that doesn't come automatically. Somebody can have a
yeah.
wonderful personality, but there's dynamics behind what occurs. We all need to be led by the hand, you know, to take us through step by step to get into those situations where you're at a point where you don't know where to go. Well, you need somebody to tell you where to go.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your kind words. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And one of the reasons I'm doing what I'm doing, both the book, but more importantly, the podcast, my Innovation Best Practices podcast with listeners in 62 countries right now, is, and it's free. You got that? It's free. Is I wanted to share, I mean, big companies have been paying me anywhere from $250,000 to over $1 million to gain access to the tools that I have. And I said, boy, I want to bring these to small and medium-sized businesses, anybody that wants to build their business in any particular shape or way. So that's what the podcast is about, to share these best practices that are known to work in very simple, direct, common sense ways. And so I'm with you. A lot of people need to have an understanding about the dynamics of what it takes to be successful. And it's not terribly complex. This is not rocket science. But if you don't touch the bases, you're going to be called out.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. And I think a great example of it is forming it in such a way the person on the other side of that desk or wherever you are, here's what you mean by what you say, because it's so important. It's not what you say, it's what they hear. It's absolutely critical.
Yeah. No, I mean, clearly you've been at this business more than a couple of days, and you understand it very clearly. And
about a week.
I'll share with you just one other thing, okay? I've talked about ideas, and one of the things that your listeners – if they're ever thinking about trying to make something better, my definition of innovation, they need ideas. And one of the things I have on the Innovation Best Practices podcast, the first six episodes, in fact, is a process that generates 12 times more ideas than brainstorming, proven in two Oklahoma State University studies, pioneered by a good friend of mine, Doug Hall. And there's four elements to that, and when you use them, you absolutely generate a very high level of high-quality ideas time after time after time. And if you don't start innovation with a lot of good ideas, the likelihood that you're going to be successful down the road goes down dramatically.
Oh, absolutely. And it's going in, with that dynamic, understanding, you know, how somebody reacts based on what you're saying. And I really believe it's the skills, having a little trouble with my voice, the skills and the experience, putting those skills to use, really is what's going to be successful or not. You can go down the same road all the time and do the same thing and never end up with anything satisfying. But when you really come down to it, if you understand the dynamic, the science, the mechanics of what goes on between marketing and sales and that end result consumer, boy, all of a sudden it makes just a tremendous amount of difference.
Oh, and you're exactly right. In fact, it was good to hear you say science, because one of the tools that we use is something called Merwin technology. Now, don't get overwhelmed by any of this. It's a very common sense tool that helps us evaluate an ideas for chances for success, a diagnosis of the message that they're using. And most of the people that we work with can, in fairly short order, double their chances for success. And remember, 75% fail and 25% succeed. So if you can double your chances for success, you've got a leg up on the rest of the world.
Oh, absolutely. And now especially is the time for this because of the competition that's out there. You know, when we went global, we ended up having to outsource. And those people that got let go came home, sat down at their kitchen table with a computer, and all of a sudden they're entrepreneurs, they're in business, and they're at a level playing field with other people because they don't have to create and order product. Store product. They can just order it as they sell it. And so when you really come down to it, there's a tremendous amount of people out there that can take what you have, learn what you have to teach, and not have to have a massive brick-and-mortar building.
Amen. You're right on. Yeah. And when I put together this Innovation Best Practices podcast, I was actually picturing that person you just described, namely somebody that's looking for an opportunity to do something new and better in their life. Maybe they lost a job and they want to use this as an opportunity to go in an entirely new and exciting direction to follow their passion. But then they stop and say, well, what are the tools that I need to be able to get that done? And that's, you need some basic tools and framework. But having said that, you can embrace those and develop them rather quickly this isn't rocket science, but you do need this kind of proven practical stuff to be able to succeed in the way you're talking about.
Oh, absolutely. And when it comes down to it, I've heard people for years say, well, gee, I'm not good at that. I've got to take time to learn how to do it. Don't do that. Hire somebody who knows how to do that.
Yeah, or better yet, get this for free, not have to hire anybody.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
In fact, in today's world, you'd be surprised how much truly insightful, powerful help is available out there in the world. And quite frankly, I'm a part of the podcast community, and so I have a bit of a bias probably in that. But the amount of information that's available out there within the podcast world is very high. Having said that, not all information is created equal. So you need to be able to filter some of this stuff and the people that really know their stuff versus those who are trying to know their stuff.
Sure, and you know the information in and of itself, it really doesn't matter. It doesn't do anything. It's the application of the information where the real power is. And we can get bombarded with information, but if somebody doesn't teach us how to apply it in the right direction, it's worthless.
Yeah, in fact, boy, you and I are on the same page here. I mean, that's exactly why I developed the book title that I did, Proven Practical. Because if it isn't proven, and if it isn't practical, quite frankly, I don't have a lot of interest. In fact, when I was a professor at Arizona State University, I would tell my class, if you took this class because you want to learn theory in whatever course I was teaching, I'm not your guy. Because I come from the real world of companies like Procter & Gamble and Gallo, I only know what's proven practical stuff, and that's what I'm going to teach. And it's that kind of attitude that's going to allow you to get more traction on what you do learn and be able to apply it more quickly.
Wonderful. We're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website where we can find you at and get what we need to get.
Good. Thank you. Innovate to Grow Experts is at i2ge.com. i2ge.com. Thanks.
Oh, wonderful. And by the way, Richard, we'll have you come back one day and I'll have my voice back and we can do an interview. Okay. Hey, by the way, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. Yo. Okay, thanks. Bye. Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Ron Jolly with us. We're going to talk about building the 21st century child. It's an instruction manual, which I think every parent needs. Ron is has been over 15 years working and presenting in the education marketplace. He's an author, a speaker, a workshop presenter, and has expertise in the preschool and elementary school arena. He's spoken at national and regional conferences for organizations like the NJEA, NAEYC, and the Goddard Systems, just to name a few. And let us say, Ron, hi. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Ron, you know, it just the words instructional manual, just because someone has children does not mean that they know how to properly get them prepped and ready to become an adult and go out into the world, into the marketplace, and shape and run the world, because those children today that we have running around that are yelling and screaming in the market are the same ones that are going to be running the world.
That's 100%. I mean, when you have a child, 2 or 3 days later, you're given the child, and they say, have a good day, good luck, and that's it. And then you're looking at this life form and this being in your hands, and look across to your wife or husband and go, all right, what do we do?
Yeah, and kids are so, you know, you go back 40, 50 years ago, mom and dad were real strong. You know, you didn't dare walk into the house and use a four-letter expletive. Today's world is completely different. We have a different kind of a child out there. We have a child that's smarter than they've ever been before. You know, you got the computer and so on and so forth. And I think what happens out there, I want to talk about what you talk about, but bullying, that kids today are they become threatened by other kids. And so if somebody threatens you, you shut them up. You put them against the wall. You do something that's going to cause them to, quote-unquote, respect you, or maybe you think that's respect. There is a lot of that today, the bullying, not only in schools with kids, but in businesses today, in every area that you could consider. People need to scare people, and the way you do it is you threaten them.
And that's one of the problems, is that we don't realize where it actually starts. Like, you hit it spot on. You're talking about in schools and you're talking about in corporations. You can have somebody that accidentally bullies their husband or wife in the morning, and then the husband or wife goes to work, and now they feel diminished, and the first opportunity they're looking to just make somebody feel a little bit bad about themselves so that they can get their perceived psychological rush back. That's exactly what happens. I mean, you send one person off to work. Mom's a teacher. She goes to a school. She's having a bad day. It's this cycle that continues over and over. It's human.
No, absolutely. And Ron has taken a step farther today. When I was a kid, if somebody bullied you, they beat you up, they chased you home, that was about the end of it. But, I mean, there are kids today that I've seen it on television where, you know, they've got the cyberbullying, and maybe it's a young man or young woman that commits suicide because they can't emotionally deal with it. And I've watched these bullies in their cars screaming and yelling at the grave sites, you know, with a burial going on. So there's a something to this. It's not just bullying like bullying was in the old days. There's a dynamic here.
Right. And what's happening is that it's like, if you really take a look at it, it's more of like an energy transfer. It's an energy transfer where somebody loses, like, their sensation, their feeling of power, even though really the feeling of power only exists in their mind. So they go ahead and now look for an opportunity to make somebody else feel bad. It could be even something as small as if you're having a bad day, or you're having a great day, and you pull up to an intersection, and somebody waves in that they want to cut in front of you, and, you know, your coffee, your tea is perfect, you wave them in, and it's fantastic. And they have a good day, they smile, they wave back. Next day, you drive to that same intersection, but right before that, somebody cut you off, or you spilled your coffee, or what have you. Now you see that same person the next day at that same intersection, you're not going to let them in. You're going to tap that accelerator and make them feel upset about it, because you feel like something happened to you when, in fact, really nothing did. This is all perceived in the mind. And then now what happens is you feel better, but you were a bully. You just created a victim. You don't know what happened to that person that now drives off, and now who they affect.
Sure. Power, power, power. There is a term that you use, the bully victim circle. What is that?
Well, basically what happens, it's a circle that goes back and forth. If you get a bully, just doesn't wake up and decide one day, you know what, I'm going to bully somebody. Every bully that I've ever met has been a victim of something, has been a victim of somebody else, has been a victim of whatever the situation might be. They don't want to feel like a victim, so to get that power back, they go and bully somebody else because they don't have a conversation with somebody. Like, if you're in pain and you're having a conversation with somebody, then they can talk you through it. You talk to them about, this is what I'm feeling, this is why I feel diminished, and then you empower yourself from within. If you don't do that, you keep that victim mentality going. Eventually, every victim turns into a bully, and it's unfortunate what's happening. Like you said, you know, back in the day, my best friend from fifth grade, we beat each other up and afterwards picked each other off the ground and said, hey, that was a nice punch. You hit pretty hard. You want to go do something? And that was it. But the problem is that you can't squash the bully victim circle when you have systems that are designed in schools to keep the bully victim circle going which in turn then just affects everyone. I mean, you got to look at it from a perspective of if a superintendent of a school gets bullied by a bully's parents who are choosing not to accept responsibility for their child, but in turn, oh, you called my child the bully. Well, how dare you? I'm going to go in and I'm going to sue you and this and that. Basically, what's happening is the bully's parents bully the superintendent, who turns around and bullies the principal, who turns around and bullies the teacher, and in the end of it, the child is the one that gets the brunt of it because they keep that circle going instead of, you know, a superintendent or a principal saying to a parent, you know what, your child's a bully. This is the proof of what your child's done. You want to sue us, go ahead and sue us. We're going to do what's best for the child.
Yeah, Ron, how does zero tolerance in the schools, how does that tie into what you just said?
Well, what happens is zero tolerance started about, I'd say, 20 years ago. I'm 39. When I was about 19 years old, I remember my sister coming home. She's 7 years younger. In her middle school, somebody came into the school with a gun. So around 20 years ago, zero tolerance policy started happening everywhere, which were basically designed, if you bring a weapon into the school, you're immediately kicked out and you're suspended, which, I mean, I fully understand it's about the safety of the kids. The problem that started is because our society has become less powerful with this ridiculous political correctness, where instead of being empowered, it's about tattletaling and whining and saying, I don't like this, I don't like that. We gave up responsibility. When you give up power, when you give up responsibility, you give up power. So now schools are so afraid of this perceived lawsuit or this imaginary lawsuit that's going to come at them from whatever direction, they use zero tolerance for anything. So when I have a conversation, like I do bullying assembly programs, and I talk to the bullies and the victims and the students and the bystanders, but I talk to the kids and I have the kids explain to mom and dad, you know, when I get into a fight, if I put my hands up to defend myself, I'm suspended. I mean, yeah. And that immediately it happens. So if we were adults and you were in the street walking with your family and somebody attacked you, and whether you're a martial artist or not, and you defended your family, the police officer wouldn't say you're going to jail too. They would do the due diligence, do the research, speak to the witnesses, find out what happened, and then go to you and say, would you like to press charges? It used to be like that back in the day, where the principal or the vice principal would bring in the bully, would bring in the victim. They would talk to each other, figure out what happened, and really dish out consequences based on how they're deserved. Now they use zero tolerance, anything. I know of a situation where there was a boy who he was a first grader. It was Valentine's Day. He went up to a girl and he kissed her on the hand. The teacher freaked out because now instead of handling it like she should have, all she thinks about is she can lose her job. She then sends a letter over to the principal. The principal, all he thinks about is I could lose my job. And then they suspend the child for 3 days for sexual harassment, a first grader. It's horrible. A third grader opens up her lunchbox, and these are all situations that I read, that they put all over the newspaper. Third grader opens up her lunchbox. Mom has an apple in there, puts a plastic knife. You know, old school mom, you got to cut the apple with the knife. The girl goes up to the teacher and tells her, my mom made a mistake. She put this in my thing. So the child admits it. The child gets suspended for weapon possession, because the whole entire thing about public schools now is we got to cover ourselves so we don't lose our jobs, and then hopefully somewhere in the process we can do something to help the kids. And that's what now zero tolerance is teaching kids. If you put your hands up and defend yourself, you're going to get in trouble. So what do kids do now? Instead of fighting back or getting help or doing this or doing that, they allow themselves to get beaten up. They tell somebody and nothing changes. They also have that mindset when they get off the school bus, off the school grounds, where really it should be different. There you can defend yourself, do what you want, and then the kid stays a victim longer and longer. And then eventually at some point, the one child chooses, I'm not going to be a victim anymore, and they either become a bully on themselves, which is why bully side is a disgusting word that we actually have in our society, or they go in and they decide to shoot other kids that did it. I mean, when I was 12 years old, I had to fake a suicide attempt to get out of the military school because I was going to get something called the blanket party by all these cadets because they had somebody, they wanted to blame me for something I didn't do. I faked the suicide attempt. I took a bottle of brass cleaner and said, down the hatch. And obviously I didn't swallow it, but I was immediately rushed to the hospital. And then finally everybody came in. My parents saw this. DIFAS was called, Division of Youth and Family Services. And a year later they shut the place down. I understand the terror and the horror of having that mindset of, I don't know what I can do. The only way out of this is to kill myself or other people. And
sure,
people don't understand. Yeah, sorry.
Well, yeah, but the parents today, the problem there is their hands are tied. You know, if your kid steps on the line, you swat the kid in the butt, you got the police on your doorstep, or you've got, child rescue, et cetera, et cetera. So
right.
Parents, excuse me, my voice is starting to crack a little bit.
No.
So, but anyhow, so you got a parent really not having the full control to be responsible for
right.
the actions with that child.
Well, and you know what it is? The key is this. Like, I'll give you a little background on myself. I'm a martial artist first. I started martial arts when I was 12. I have a master's in education. I got that second. So my job is to make sure that children are protected and safe so that when they go out into the real world as an adult, they already have life skills and they have things that are going to help them in life. So with
yes.
me, you defend yourself first. What I do is when I do my program, I talk to the kids, and then I have the parents open up a conversation with the kids. And there's four questions that need to be communicated so that you can actually have open communication. And the questions are real simple. Number one, what do I want you to do if somebody's making fun of you? And usually, you know, someone makes fun of you, it's psychological bullying, go tell somebody. And that's across the board, whether it's a work situation, whether it's adults, whether it's kids. Second question is, I want the child to ask, what do you want me to do when somebody's hitting me? Meaning when someone's got you on the ground, they're punching you in the face, and the school is telling you, don't put your hands up. When you're done getting your face bloodied, go tell someone, which is pretty much the message that you're getting. You know, I want the mom and dad to realize this is what's happening in your school so that mom and dad can go to the kid and say, you know what, no, hit back, fight back. I mean, listen, I've had a situation where a parent was such a pacifist, he said, I don't want my child to do anything. And this 12-year-old boy was sitting there timid and cringing, and I'm like, just want to be clear, in a room of 80 parents, I want to be clear, what you are telling your child is right now, if someone's punching them, you don't want them to put their hands up, you want them to get beaten up and tell someone. And the parent said yes. I'm like, all right, so listen, I can't do anything about that. I felt horrible for the kid, but at least that communication was there. And then the third question is, what do I want you to do if someone's hitting you after school? Or on a Saturday? And the fourth question is, what do I want you to do if somebody's making fun of you on the computer? Because kids don't really have that communication with the parents, so when somebody cyberbullies them, they don't know what to do.
You know, one of the things that I've seen with parents also, it was one of the summer, you know, with the colleges and the kids are out there, they're at the beach, they're drinking, they're twerking, they're doing all their stuff. And I remember one of the reporters walked up to a young girl, and she couldn't have been more than about 22, 23 years old, and she's doing all the wild dancing, you know, and she's got her top bare and so on and so forth. And the reporter said, what do you think your parents would say if they saw you this way? And her response was, F my parents. That, see, there's the key, too. There's no respect anymore. I remember when I was a kid, you know, we didn't get into trouble. We got into mischief. It was a whole different world. And if
right.
mom and dad said something, you just watch out because you don't want to go home to face that. We don't have that anymore.
Well, what's happening is parents are trying to be friends with the kids.
Yeah.
They have something. They're working more. They work harder. Mom is now not home at 3 o'clock when the kid gets there. Mom's home at 6 because she just had a long day at work. She feels guilty. Like, I also do behavior management training for parents and teachers. And I have to explain to teachers that these parents, sometimes they create this expectation that the teachers will discipline their child at school so that when they get home, the child will still maintain that disciplined, you know, personality. But in reality, every child tests every individual adult, and the child responds to the adult based on the responses of the adult. And what's happening is the parents feel so guilty that they're working. They have the kids' pictures on their Facebook, on their phone, on their computer screen. Then all of a sudden the child comes home and starts to flip out, and they feel so bad. They don't want to tell that child no, and they don't let the child, they let the child go to sleep at 11 o'clock at night. They let them eat whatever they want. They watch whatever TV, and they're just trying to appease them. And it's nothing to do with the child. It's his own self-guilt that they're bringing upon themselves that they don't deserve. They don't deserve this self-guilt that they're putting upon themselves. And in essence, they're kind of bullying themselves. But the child suffers.
Sure. You know, and when you really take a look at it today, kids don't care. And because they quote-unquote know the, not everyone, obviously, but in general, they know more than their parents. What do their parents know? Nothing. You know, because it's in a cyber world. So you've got that you're running up against. And the other thing is we started running out of time. So let me ask you this. Is there a website we can find you and also find more about what you're doing?
Yes. Thank you for asking. I appreciate that. It's ronspeak.com, www.ronspeak.com.
Wonderful. And by the way, Ron, thank you so much for being here and what you're doing out there.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me and letting me share my message. I hope that if parents have any questions or they just don't know what to do when their child's gotten bullied and the school's not helping, give me a call. Can I get my phone number too, or just the
please,
website?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
The phone
number. Okay, 732-777-1328. It's 732-777-1328. If anyone has any questions and they just don't know what to do, just please give me a call. I'd love to help them.
Yeah, and also one other thing, if anybody missed your website, it's up on ours right now so they can get it.
Great.
And again, Ron, thank you so much for being here and what you do.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks again. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to the Michael Dresser Show. Joel Bozzello with us. He's the author of The CAP Equation, a foolproof formula for unlimited success in sales. He's an author. He's a corporate speaker. He's a trainer, an expert on the heart of selling. And he says we're all in sales. Selling ourselves, our ideas, and our products can be intimidating until we unlock the secrets that all sales professionals know and use. And let us say, Joe, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, it's very interesting. You get people who have they've written a book or they get some kind of a product, a service that can really help people. And the first thing out of their mouth is, I don't know how to sell and I don't want to, but I don't like sales. and what they don't realize is if you define sales is offer and acceptance. You meet somebody, you fall in love, you want to get married, and you say, will you marry me? You've made an offer. They're going to either accept or reject. That's sales.
Right.
but with what you're doing, it's the dynamic of what to say to make sure she says yes.
Absolutely. I spend a great deal of time in three areas. Obviously, my book has a curious title, and a lot of professionals said, well, you shouldn't name it the CAP equation. You should name it something else. And the CAP equation is actually the sales methodology that I've developed and refined over 35 years. And C stands, the C in CAP, obviously an acronym. The C stands for competencies. You have to know what to say. The A stands for attitudes. You have to say it in the right way. You have to hold yourself well. You have to manage your emotions and your mindsets. And then P is for pipeline. You have to have a lot of people to see. You have to see enough people. So I love simplifying the sales process, Michael. That's my joy. That's my passion, is to simplify it for both sales professionals and regular people that wind up getting into these home-based businesses. And they're hopeful to make money. A lot of those people don't get the kind of training and understanding they need of the sales process.
And here's how simply ridiculous that it gets. Oh, 20 years ago, I was a sales manager at a radio station. And the way we used to hire, what I would do is they put an ad in the paper. I'd get, 10, 12, 15 people all at once. They'd come in, and I'd get them in a group, ask them a few questions, and then as I'd start training all of them. And then as they couldn't make it, I'd walk outside with somebody and say, thank you. They knew it was over, and we'd whittle it down to those few people who we wanted. But one of the questions that I asked the first day was to everybody individually, what's a salesman or salesperson? Huh, got to be politically correct.
Yes.
And, some of the answers I got back, I'm almost saying it was a thief, but not quite that bad. And I'm thinking to myself, if that's what you think about sales, why are you applying for the job? And I think one of the biggest things the biggest things we run into is people have no idea what sales is.
Exactly. And I've got a quick story for you. I've got to share this with you. I was in the Midwest. I'm not going to mention what group or organization I was speaking to. I don't want to embarrass anyone. But these were not just sales professionals, but these were sales trainers, sales leaders. And I said, just a show of hands, we were in a workshop. And I mentioned the five buying decisions that, all prospects make, and they make them in about the same order. I said, you all know the five buying decisions and the order they're made in. And I saw some eyeballs kind of glaze over and glass over. And I said, okay, well, I've got to ask the question then. Is it okay if I spend a few minutes and talk about the five buying decisions? And a lot of eager hands went up. And the five buying decisions that we all make today, whether we're on the side of being a buyer or you're on the side of selling your concept, your service, your idea, the five buying decisions are first you. They have to buy you. They have to like you. There has to be something about you that they trust. And then the second thing is your organization. Does your organization have a good reputation? So they first buy you, Michael, and then secondly, they buy your company. And the third is your solution. Do you have a solution that's going to create a better or new reality for them? And we don't sell products or services anymore because people now want a solution.
No.
That has changed just a little bit. So we don't data dump. We just help people understand how our product or service, what features and benefits can create a great solution for them. So once we get past that, there are only two other buying decisions that as a salesperson, whether you're a full-time sales professional, a pharmaceutical rep, an investment rep, an insurance guy, a real estate person, you could be any of those people, or you could be someone who's jumped into a part-time home-based business. But that third and fourth are critical. I'm sorry, the fourth and fifth are critical. The fourth is the cost. What is the cost? Can I afford this? Is the investment worth it? Is the new reality that just this professional salesperson has shown me, is it worth the cost? And then the fifth is actually the killer. It's a time to buy. And every one of us, regardless of, whether it's a small purchase or large, we've gotten to the point where we say, well, should I pull the trigger and buy this now, or should I wait? Should I put this off? And, of course, expert salespeople have a way of touching us emotionally to get us to buy now.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, and that's an entire internal dynamic that's brought about intentionally. But let me add something to that. And by the way, I've been losing my voice for the last couple of days, so if it disappears, you'll understand what's going on.
Well, if it disappears, should I just keep on talking?
Absolutely. Yes. Now, I'll buy one. Okay, now, there's two things that I'd like to add to what you just said.
The first
thing is, yes, we know they have to like you, they got to trust you, all that's good. But something has to happen before that. Let me tell you a quick story, true story. I'll make it quick. 20 years ago, 18, 19 years ago, in that time frame, I was up in the interior of Alaska. I was in Fairbanks. And I was at the house. I heard this explosion. So I walk out the back deck, walked over to my studio, which was in a cabin, and I opened the door, and you can smell it. My equipment was fried. We are talking burnt. So a lightning bolt had hit the power line and got in and destroyed everything. Guess who didn't have any insurance, okay? I took a financial nosedive like you wouldn't believe because
wow.
That stuff is expensive. So 4 or 5 months go by, and I'm picking up a few bucks. I'm buying a piece of equipment at a time. I'm doing all right. But in the first 3 months, I spent all my ready cash. I lost, I couldn't make the car payment, and they repossessed the car. Now, here it goes. I'm standing, I see this every time I say it. I'm standing in front of the mirror, I'm looking outside, and I hear this voice. And the voice said, no down, no credit, no problem. 2 hours later, I drove home in a brand new car. I heard what I had to hear at the time. They were speaking to me. And that's
right.
Where the key is. Now, the like and the trust and the rest of it had to come, no question. But they've got to hear that certain something that specifically relates to them to take that first step, that first action to move to the second level.
Absolutely. And the way we've said it for years in the methodology that I teach is that people will buy now because you've touched them on some emotional level, you've triggered something emotionally for them. Then they'll immediately, after they make that sale, I bet you on the way home from the dealership in that car, you were thinking up all the good logical business reasons, all the things.
Yeah.
You know, this is a great car, and I've made a great investment. You just sell yourself logically on all that data. So the right brain and left brain are important, but the left brain, the logical side of our head, is used for justifying the purchase. And if we as professional or beginning salespeople can touch a person emotionally, really ask the right questions. And that's the thing that I'm often asked this question, Michael, what's changed about sales and since you've been in the game? And really in 35 some odd years, 37 years, the only thing that's really tangibly changed is maybe 10 years or 15 years ago, we stopped pitching people. And especially over the last 5 to 7 years, as generations came into our consumer range, they wanted to be engaged. They wanted to be asked more questions. They wanted to be listened to. So now we don't pitch so much anymore. We ask a lot of questions when we're selling, and we fashion those solutions I talked about. And usually those solutions sound like custom solutions, and so they do touch people on that other level you talked about.
Joe, I think where the transition has come from, you can't sell an audience anything anymore. It doesn't work. You can't sell anybody anything anymore. It doesn't work. They have to buy it, and there's a difference between the two.
Yes.
And
a good salesperson will help them become a buyer, will facilitate that.
Yeah. Well, they have to become it. It's like this. Let me ask you a question. Can you and I'll never tell anybody your answer, okay? Can you recall a movie that you cried at?
Yes. There are
okay,
several.
Do you remember the scene?
Yes.
Okay. What was going on in that scene? Symbolically.
I believe the movie was called The Notebook. And
oh,
I think it was
a
scene. Yeah, I think it was a scene where the person had the last, they knew they had the last meaningful connection they were going to have.
Yeah. Now, symbolically in your life, don't be specific just to get the idea of this, but symbolically in your life, where was that for you? You don't have to answer that. But the point of contention is this, that at that moment, it was a recognizable emotional association that was going on in your mind. And that's your audience, whether it's a one person to consultation to a one to one across the desk or 50 million people, to be able to be successful with this, they have to live it. It's not them on the screen, it's you on the screen, and they're going through something that was recognizable with your own life. That's really where the key is. That's where the mind gets made up today. It's a chemical reaction.
Yeah, it really is. And of course, no one in sales is sent to a four-year university and given a degree in psychology.
No.
But boy, we all sure could have used one before we signed up for the job of professional salesperson.
Oh, yeah.
And professional trainer.
I'm driving down the street one day, and this happened years ago, and it was the summertime, and I had to make some more money. And there was this ad in the paper for a used car salesman, and I said, I cannot do that. There's no way I'm going to do that. And my car pulled into the lot. It wasn't me. The car pulled into the lot. So I get out of the car and I walk in. I sit down. The manager looks at me and he said, what do you know about cars? I said, nothing, but I can sell anything. He said, when do you want to go to work? That was the key. He had what he heard, what he had to hear.
Wow.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, No, it's interesting. When we really stop to, model a person, talk like they talk, use some of the words and phrases that they use, and Tony Robbins has done a great job of teaching this over the years. Part of it is incorporated in this very complex study called neurolinguistic programming, but
yeah.
I've dumbed it down over the years because I didn't, we never had the time to really teach that to someone quickly and get them up and running, especially
sure.
in commission sales where you have a very short window. But another way of describing NLP is just really modeling, just understanding the speed in which a person talks. Some people talk very fast, and some people, they kind of, amble on, and just matching their tonality, their cadence, and even body language, and just modeling a person sometimes does wonders. People buy from people that they like, but they also buy from people that they believe are like them.
Yeah. Oh, I think more than like them. People talk about the compelling reason to buy. And I can't afford it. There's no such thing as that. It's we haven't given them the compelling reason. Like, example, let's say you've got a teenage daughter, and don't answer the questions that I ask you. And if I ask you if you can come up with $300,000 by tomorrow at noon, and you say to me, "No, I can't do that." So now I've captured your daughter. At noon tomorrow, if you don't come up with $350,000 in cash, I'm going to kill her. And if you think I'm kidding, at midnight tonight, I'm going to start sending you pieces of ears and toes and noses and stuff. How fast could you come up with that money?
Well, this sounds like a bad Quentin Tarantino movie, but I come
well,
up with
is,
the money
actually.
Instantly.
but that's the whole point, that compelling reason to buy, because
yes.
I've seen it for years. Somebody buys a car, they go through that left brain logical yada yada across the board, and the yes and the no's and whatever. But once they've made the buying decision, they get in the car, they sit in it, they smell the new seats, they feel good in it. And why did they buy it? Because it makes them feel good.
Yeah. It's that feeling.
Yeah.
Recently, I wonder if you know, I'm going to ask you a question if you don't mind.
Sure.
I wonder if you know how many people, because I've been doing a lot of research lately on the subject of how many people actually sell something in America, either part-time or full-time. You have your hardcore full-time professionals, and you have a lot of people that are in part-time home-based businesses or network marketing businesses like the Herbalifes and the Stella and Dots and all those fine companies.
Sure.
And then you also have people who are just entrepreneurial who start businesses at home and then they have to market themselves and sell their products. But do you have a guess of how many people sell something full-time or part-time in America?
Oh, okay. We have I'm going to guess. I don't know. But we have a population of, about 350 million here?
Right.
Okay. All right. So break that down to adult. I would say minimally 100 million people.
Okay, I would love that if it is 100 million people, it's about 45 to 50 million people, about 1 in maybe 7, 1 in 6, something like that.
Okay.
And so that
but
means...
then again, too, they haven't defined what selling is. What kind of pick an industry. Anything.
Well, it could be insurance, real estate, pharmaceuticals.
Well, we know, but there's sales there. But pick an industry you wouldn't think sales would go on.
Huh. I'm thinking of customer service. I'm thinking of some of the worst salespeople I've seen are I had a guy yesterday at the meat counter at Albertsons who was absolutely shut down and turned off.
Okay, but these people behind the counter are selling.
He should have been selling.
Oh, what about a waitress? The waitress job isn't to give you food on the table. It's his or her job, a waiter or waitress, to come up to the table and say, this would be very good with that. That would be great with that. I'm going to turn a word around that you used earlier when you said solution. Let's give it another word. Instead of solution, let's put the word answer in there, because the only thing that will motivate you is finding or experiencing an answer to something you're looking for or you didn't know you were looking for. The only thing that you sell is an answer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And the only way you know to craft that answer or solution or new reality is by asking incredibly intuitive questions, open-ended questions, and following them up with even better open-ended questions.
But see, there's the key. That's why people need, you know, the businesses need people like you. You see, if you ask the wrong question, you're going to get the right answer to the wrong question. You don't get anywhere.
Right.
If you ask the right questions, you get the right answers. You move in the right direction. I got a brick-and-mortar store, hypothetically. You come into the store. If you have stepped into that store, you obviously are interested in what the offerings are in that store. One of two things will happen. You're either going to buy, or I, as the owner, will talk you out of it.
Yeah, it's your game to lose.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh,
we've been saying for years now that the quality of your sales presentation will equate to the quality of your questions, and we've spent a great deal of time over the last 5 to 7 years helping salespeople craft the best questions for their product, their service, their program. And there's a lot of magic in that.
Yeah.
And that's that one big paradigm shift. When I was asked that question, Michael, what's really changed? That's the thing that's changed. We don't really pitch anymore. It's not a flat line pushing out what we also call data dump. It really is a conversation. It really is an exchange that engages the prospect.
Oh, absolutely, no question. I really hate to do this, Joe, but we are just about out of time. So can you give me a website we can find you, find the book, find out where you're teaching?
Oh, absolutely. I have, I'd love to. I have a couple things I'd like to do. First, I'd love for everyone to have the CAP Equation book, and it's spelled C-A-P, just like a baseball cap, CAP Equation, E-Q-U-A-T-I-O-N. And they can go to Amazon and put in CAP Equation, and that book will come up. Also, is it okay if I give the listeners a gift?
Absolutely.
If they go to my website, which is also capequation.com, there's a little red button that says, a little box that says free tools. If they just hit that, put in their first name and email address, for the next 2 days, I'm just going to keep this up for your audience. It's called Unconsciously Great Prospecting. It's a free ebook and audio program, 1 hour audio program. It's from our Sales Master Transcript series, and I just love for the listeners to get something free and experience that.
Wonderful. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, take care. Bye bye.
All right. Bye bye now.
I'm Michael Dresser.
And I'm Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is?
It is a wrap.
The music softly dies.